Today on Triangulation, a good friend, a regular on many of our shows, and an expert on the future, Amy Webb, talks about her new book, The Big Nine, How the Tech Titans and Their Thinking Machines Could Warp Humanity. Next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Triangulation, episode 387, recorded Friday, March 1st, 2019. Amy Webb. Today on Triangulation, a good friend and a repeat visitor to Triangulation. In fact, she's a regular on many of our shows. Amy Webb is here. She's a professor of strategic foresight at the NYU Stern School of Business, the founder of the Future Today Institute, a futurist. In fact, the last time she was on this show, she was here to talk about her book, The Signals Are Talking. Amy, welcome to Triangulation. It's great to have you back.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Amy's always a great guest on our show because, because of her kind of focus on the future, which I think gives her a unique way of thinking about the things we're dealing with today. And, you know, we're all so mired in the middle of what's going on right now that we have a hard time kind of seeing our way outside of that. So it's really nice to break out of that and get a better perspective. And one of the things we talk a lot about with Amy is artificial intelligence. Her new book is called The Big Nine. The Big Nine are Google, IBM, Amazon, Facebook, Alibaba, Microsoft, Tencent, Apple, and Baidu. How the Tech Titans and Their Thinking Machines Could Warp Humanity. And as with all of Amy's writing, it's clear, it's precise, and it's very provocative. Who are the G Mafia?
We'll just start right out of the gate.
What's the G Mafia?
So there are nine companies that are essentially responsible for the lion's share of patents, most of the funding, a lot of the IP. They're partnered with universities that are essentially creating the future of AI and as a result, making decisions about the future of humanity. So three of them are in China. Those are the BAT, Baidu, Alibaba, and Tencent. And the other six are what I call the G Mafia. Those are based in the United States. So that's Google, Apple, Microsoft, IBM, Facebook, and Amazon. And, you know, they do kind of function as a mafia in the truest sense of the word. I'm not necessarily meaning it to be pejorative.
It's not a crime family, but it is a family.
Right.
They operate in concert.
That's right. You know, and for the most part, it doesn't mean that Salesforce and LinkedIn aren't also doing really interesting things or NVIDIA building out really interesting chipsets or all the rest of it. But it's these companies that are building the custom silicon. They're building chips. It's their frameworks. It's increasingly their AI clouds that are ushering us into the future. And of course, all of it is predicated on data, and they own the lion's share of our data as well.
That's one thing that's interesting. In the past, innovation often comes from garages and unexpected places and small companies. In fact, it's often been thought that big companies are incapable of innovation because of the innovator's dilemma, their stake in the way things are as opposed to the way things might be. But this is very different. It's really these are massive companies. Is it only giant companies that can do this kind of thing?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And I think a really smart point about innovation. We're definitely seeing innovation in the field of AI coming from multiple different directions, and not just startups, but people working in different fields like healthcare. So there's plenty of innovation happening, but all of it connects in some way to one of those nine companies. And that is because you're either using their cloud or you're using TensorFlow, which is Google's framework. You are in some way tethered to these organizations, and the organizations are essentially building out the tools and the frameworks that are intended to make optimal decisions, to optimize, but they're not necessarily optimizing on behalf of all of us, which is a bit of a problem.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because you mentioned TensorFlow, Amazon, Apple, Microsoft all have platforms that they invite researchers to use. And there's you know, there's a lot to be said for things like TensorFlow. You get a lot of power for very little money, great data processing capabilities. Is it all really just an attempt to co-opt whatever's going on and make sure it's happening under their roof?
Yeah, so I want to make this point very clear because I realize the title of the book sounds quite ominous. So I don't think that these companies are out to get us. I do not believe Google to be evil. I don't think that there is a small group of minions working for Bezos over at Amazon who are intentionally building systems that could in some way cause harm to humanity in the future. I don't think that's what's happening. I think what's happening is that in the United States, we have a concentration of people building these systems at publicly traded companies. And publicly traded companies have responsibilities to their shareholders. And shareholders and investors have been made huge promises about how much AI is going to deliver, whether that's in new products and services or automated systems or human longevity. And what's happening is that there's a lot of impatience. And so, you know, as a result of that, Wall Street, I think, is calling a lot of the shots. And people who are working in the trenches, you know, who may say, you know, let's take a little bit of time and see if what we're doing is going to create future risk. Or let's talk about interoperability and making sure that all of these systems can talk to each other so that in the future, individual data is not being held hostage. You know, there's not the time to do that, and there's no financial incentive to do it because of our market-driven economy. So I think that's what's going on. And there's so much competition that, again, I think that a lot of decisions are being made quickly or under duress. And I think that's when it comes to something like AI, which is not a single technology, but many technologies predicated on making decisions on our behalf. I think it's a good idea for us to stop for a few minutes and ask about, you know, what does it all mean?
Right. And there is a very fine line between malicious acting and just acting and acting fast so you can meet the market's demands. It might end up with the same result.
Yeah, and I don't think the investors are bad dudes either.
No.
I don't think there's like a single, I mean, in at least in as far as our part of the Big Nine are concerned, I don't think there's a single bad actor who is pursuing the ill effects of AI. I don't think that's what's happening. I think it's just a systems level problem. And there's a lot of forces conspiring against what I think is best for the future of humanity. I mean, I don't think it's any one person or any one community of people. I think we just have a big, gnarly problem in our hands.
So I made the mistake here that I think a lot of us make of jumping right in and not getting a sense of what AI is. I think we all kind of assume we know what AI is. You start the book with a brief history of AI. What is AI?
Yeah, what is this stuff?
What is it?
So the easiest way to understand artificial intelligence, which again is not a single technology, but sort of an umbrella term for many different technologies, is an automated system that makes decisions using data. And so that's like it.
And it's kind of a computer program. I mean, isn't that true of all computer programs?
I mean, yes and no. So if we think of the first era of computing as being tabulation, so that's mid-1800s, Charles Babbage, Ada Lovelace, and the second era of computing being about programmable systems. So ENIAC and some of those early computers that used language that was more akin to how we speak, so that, you know, and then building out the architecture differently and all that stuff. That's that second era. So if I think a good way to think about AI is the third era of computing, where we build initial systems and then those systems using automated processes perform tasks at the same level that we humans can or better, faster, more efficiently than we can. So it's part of a long continuum of computing. It's not a totally novel, different, unique thing.
I've always tried to use as a definition for AI is that it isn't von Neumann architecture is a very, you know, kind of deterministic, you do this, then you do this, then you do this list of, it's a recipe, it's a cookbook for a computer, and it may involve data. To me, AI requires that it go beyond that, that in some ways the computer is writing its own program based on what it's learned in machine learning from the outside world. And maybe a good example would be the programs used to play chess and then later Go. In the earliest days, Deep Blue, IBM's chess-playing computer, which essentially became Watson, was very much a program. It wasn't, I don't think you could call it artificial intelligence. It was fed a lot of positions and games and given a lot of very, you know, concrete rules about how to judge a position. It was done so at great effort with the help of a lot of grandmasters. In fact, one of the criticisms of it when it beat the world champion was it was designed specifically to beat that one player. It had a lot of, you know, kind of specific algorithms. Then along comes the Google AI, AlphaGo, which was much more of a kind of a generative program, beat Lee Sedol, the world champion Go player, in a game that most people considered almost intractable from a computer program point of view, because unlike chess, which while it has a very, very, very large number of possible positions, it's a finite number. I guess it's finite in Go too, but it's, you know, many orders of magnitude larger, much more difficult to solve. But then along comes AlphaZero, which is, in my mind, true AI. And by the way, AlphaZero just recently beat AlphaGo 128 games to nothing, beating the best Go-playing machine of all time, 128 games to nothing. And nobody did anything to teach AlphaGo. They simply provided it with the rules of the game and let it teach itself. Is that, that's true AI, in my opinion. Would you agree?
Well, so this is where language matters. And so we went from AlphaGo to AlphaGo Zero to now AlphaZero. And what's interesting about AlphaZero is not just that it went from knowing nothing to playing Go at a superhuman level, but it was it's actually competent in multiple games. So it's an example of hierarchical reinforcement learning and multitask learning.
Right. It learned three major games in 4 hours.
Right.
By simply playing millions and millions of games against itself.
So now so I want to unpack, because you gave a great summary and I want to unpack some of it.
Okay.
Even after the term artificial intelligence was coined at a meeting at Dartmouth in 1956 by McCarthy and Minsky, even after that, and to be fair, we have always been approximating how strong a computer is using the measurements that we would use to determine how smart a person is. So we're constantly talking about cognition. And we've seen plenty of examples of AI for decades. We just don't think of it as being a decision versus a program. So the spam filter that most of us encounter now in our inboxes for email, or if you use text messaging on Android, and I'm assuming, Leo, you're an iPhone user, so I'm assuming this is true for you as well. There's the suggested auto replies.
No, iPhones, right? Unfortunately lack that, because Apple doesn't want to do this.
Oh, okay.
But I know what you're talking about, inbox, and of course Google Messages will do this reply feature. Yeah.
Right. So those are little tiny examples of artificial narrow intelligence.
It's Bayesian. They're using statistics to kind of.
Sure. Now you can.
They're not really understanding anything.
Well, so that's sort of the crux of how we got to now. And that is, what's the difference between cognition and just a machine fulfilling its program over and over again, faster, more interesting, whatever it may be. And I think that that's where a lot of people get stuck, because we keep talking about the difference between artificial narrow intelligence and artificial general intelligence.
This is an important distinction.
I mean, and honestly, all of the AI in our daily lives, we don't even recognize as being AI anymore, because our brains have moved forward to some big event horizon where some walking, talking robot is, you know, going to fool us. I would argue that AlphaZero is a great example of artificial general intelligence, But, you know, I think a lot of people in the community would not call it that. But it points to a problem, which is everybody wants to know when are the robots coming to kill us? When is a computer going to be smarter than us, right? And in order to answer that question, we need some kind of classification. And so the next part of that conversation is, when is AGI, you know, and how, who will do it and how soon?
Right.
In order to get to that point, you would have to have a test. And the current tests to test the strength of these systems are built on and have always been built on deceit or repetition, replication.
Right. This which is would why be the Turing test where...
That's right. Or all the chess games and the checkers games and the Go games.
Yeah.
Right. So deceit or replication.
Right.
And I think the reality is we're maybe not doing this right. You know, a machine doesn't have to think exactly like we do or beat a human player to be powerful enough to have significant impact on society.
You actually address this in this first chapter. And I think this is a critical distinction. Sometimes when we talk about AI, we assume that at some point AI will create mind. And I don't know if we really make the distinction between cognitive work and what we think of as mind. And I don't know if when you talk about the Terminator coming to destroy us, that implies mind, that implies will, that implies feelings, that implies desires. And there's no evidence at all to date that however sophisticated an AI becomes, however smart Alpha Zero becomes, it will ever generate mind. There seems to be a great leap between the two.
Sure.
We don't know, I guess.
There's a bunch. There's a bunch here to think about. First, and Minsky had something called the Society of Mind, where a lot of these philosophical and existential questions were asked, and he attempted to answer them. So there's a bunch here. First of all, we don't know necessarily what mind is,
right.
And we actually know very little about how the human brain works. So from a mechanical point of view, when we're talking about the architecture of AI frameworks and systems, there's a departure from the von Neumann architecture into building new types of networks that look and sort of function differently and require a lot more compute, et cetera, et cetera. So that's mechanical. When we're talking about things like emotion and feeling, I think part of our assumption is that these are innate human traits, but we don't have any way to prove that. So if you were to, I don't know. I mean, and that was one of the things that the guys at Dartmouth were sort of trying to figure out.
Yeah. I've had this debate with Ray Kurzweil, of course, is a later era, but definitely heavily influenced by Minsky, MacArthur, and Shannon, McCarthy and Shannon. Mm-hmm. But he says it's irrelevant.
that's what I was going to say. It doesn't matter because whether or not a machine feels something is not actually something that I care about. Systems making choices instead of decisions, I think, is a better way to think about this. And going back to that Alpha Zero and Alpha Go Zero example for a moment, you know, at some point when the algorithm was re-released and it was learning how to play, you know, Go again, and it got very, very fast, part of the self-improvement and replication happened because a choice was made. And the choice was to throw out the human strategy and try something totally different. So again, we tend to conflate human intelligence with computational strength and these newer systems, this newer age of computing. And I think we probably should stop thinking about trying to replicate or fool ourselves and instead recognize AI as more of like an alien intelligence than an artificial intelligence. And that opens us up for the possibilities of systems making choices that we have not thought through before. And in fact, some of the people who are at the farthest, most cutting edge of the field are doing exactly that. They are trying to find those areas of unpredictability, because when the system starts behaving in ways that we didn't think about in advance, that is one sign of improvement, or it's a measurement of improvement.
Yeah. In fact, AlphaZero, modern Go masters look at some of AlphaZero's play, and instead of thinking it mechanistic, as earlier attempts have been thought of, say, this is art. This is beautiful. It's making moves we never expected that are incredibly elegant. And so, I mean, that's obviously a value judgment, but mind is really all about a value judgment. I mean, we don't know what it's funny because I think a lot of it comes down to kind of a philosophy of mind, whether you believe that everything that happens in the mind ultimately determines everything you feel, including love and hate and joy. It's all mechanistic brain chemistry, or there is some other thing that's happening, and that's really the dividing line. But as you say, as Ray said, what does it matter?
Right.
I like the idea of thinking of it as an alien mind, just a mind, alien from outer space, but alien in a way that we just don't understand it any more than we understand ourselves, to be honest with you.
Right. And part of the reason why I think that's a better characteristic is because when we assume systems that we build in our image that we create are going to behave the way that we do, we are not intentionally looking for outliers and focusing on uncertainty. The problem is that, like, name a time in history when technology didn't at some point fork and do something like get repurposed in some way we didn't think, get, you know, evolve in some way nobody thought about in advance. So if we start thinking about AI, we can keep the same acronym, so that's fine. Nobody has to change their logos. if we think about it as alien intelligence, then I think that gives us the cognitive space and the ability to say, you know what? We actually don't know. Like, we can try to model this out, but we don't really know what this is going to do. And so we're gonna approach this with some deep curiosity. We're gonna confront uncertainty, and we're gonna try to model out some of this in advance. And maybe that means we're gonna have some guardrails, and we're gonna open ourselves up and do serious collaboration. You know, I think that is a really smart way forward.
Yeah, the only reason I bring it up is because often the argument against AI is this kind of Terminator argument or Matrix argument, where the machines become adversaries and have motives and desires of their own. Ray Kurzweil always said, oh, you don't have to worry about that. The machines are going to love us as their creators. That never satisfied me either. I kind of prefer the notion that without mind, a machine is, any AI is absolutely doing what we've instructed it to do. The difference is, instead of telling it how to do it, we give it the rules and we let it figure out how to do it itself, just as we did with AlphaZero.
Which is fine.
As long as we're giving them the rules, that's fine.
Well, Leo, if you're the one who gave them the rules, I'm totally down with that. That's okay with me.
Who's giving them the rules?
That's right. And so again, this is where things get complicated. I think that the people creating the rules are not bad people. I just think that, like with everybody, you tend to work in homogenous groups. You tend to have a narrow worldview, and it's hard to represent everybody. And if you're working under a lot of pressure and you have to produce stuff quickly, you don't have the luxury of mapping out risk and planning for risk. So yeah, let's also just, you know, there's a whole other piece of this conversation, which is that, you know, maybe what, you know, we're living by some kind of legacy code. Like, we are programmed, right? And maybe we're just transferring our human legacy code into more mechanical, you know, systems, different mechanical systems. So, for what that's worth.
We're talking to Amy Webb. She is a futurist, the founder of the Future Today Institute, a regular on our shows, and the author of a couple of books, including Signals Are Talking, and now the new book, The Big Nine, How the Tech Titans and Their Thinking Machines Could Warp Humanity. And really, what this is a call to step back. Let's think about the implications of what we're doing, because in a way, we're in a race right now. You say that it's China and versus the U.S., that these are the big two players. Is that the case?
Yes. So again, like, the G Mafia are based in the Valley, and the Bat are based in China. But I also just want to point out, we seem to keep approaching big geopolitical issues as though it's the U.S. pitted against China, and there's no other country on the planet. You know, the the decisions that we are making affect everybody everywhere. It just so happens that at the moment, there's a ton of capital, there's a ton of activity, and we are starting to see some real breakthroughs. So in the United States, there's an antagonistic relationship, or just sort of a non-relationship, between Washington, D.C. and the tech community in Silicon Valley. There are plenty of tiny examples of how that's starting to change, but for the most part, we spend very little money outside of the military on serious R&D in science and tech. Technically, we have a few departments that focus on this, but they're woefully understaffed. And all you have to do is click on any, listen to any episode of Twit over the past like 3 years, and at some point, somebody's going to bring up one of these companies did something wrong.
Right.
Somebody got upset about it. Right. That's not what's happening in China. So in China, the bat may be independent companies, but by virtue of the fact that they are Chinese companies, they are very much under the thumb of Beijing. You have a president, Xi Jinping, who is brilliant, who is young, and who has effectively been elected president for life because they've had a few governmental and policy changes there. China has a strong history of long-term planning. And some of their initiatives are starting to shift the balance of global power. So there's something called the Brick and Road Initiative, which looks like an infrastructure plan. Basically, a lot of countries can partner with China along its old Silk Road route, but also in places like Africa and South America now. And China's building bridges, it's fixing roads, it's bringing infrastructure. All of this is terrific. However, it's also a program that is helping usher in a new kind of era of AI. So in 58 pilot countries around the world right now, Chinese 5G is in the process of being deployed. Small cells are in the process of being deployed. There are vast data collection networks that we've already seen operational in parts of China that are now being deployed to other countries. And so to me, what's concerning about this is while we argue amongst ourselves in the West and allow market forces to dictate the future, there's a big consolidation of power happening in China. And China has a vested interest in seeing itself emerge as a new world power with a new world order, where it has tremendous leverage and is calling the shots. We're already starting to see that play out.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the United States, of course, has a long history of using international aid to do that as well, but we seem to have pulled back. You know, the U.S. has always struggled with this kind of isolationist streak going back more than 100 years, and we are in the down cycle of that right now, where we're really pulling inward. It sounds like you think this is a bad time to pull inward, but I don't think you're saying, oh, we should be doing what China's doing either.
No, and this is the problem. The problem is, I'm sort of politically independent, and I like open and free markets, and I think everybody should have a shot at success, and I don't like big, heavy-handed regulation. With all that being said, there's nobody minding the story. Artificial intelligence, there's no switch. You can't just shut it. Like, there's no way to shut it off.
Is it a Pandora's box? Once you open it, it's there, and...
Well, I mean, it is, right? It has been. It's been in some form of development now for hundreds of years. So it's just part of our continuum. The challenge is that in the United States, because we are a functioning democracy, our leadership changes hands every couple of years. The downside, of course, is that we've become really politically divided. And as a result of that, technology and science have unfortunately become victims of that political infighting and our own political instability, which means that at the tail end of the Obama administration, there was a national AI policy. There were some parameters in it. You know, it wasn't it didn't sort of act on its own. It would have taken some departments and some people and everything, some funding, but we had the sort of bones of it. We wind up with a new president who wants to go in a different direction. And whoever the president is after this one,
that happens every 4 to 8 years. That's the problem.
That's right.
Meanwhile, President Xi is president for life.
That's right. And I'm not saying
it's almost cultural, though. As you said, the Chinese have a long-term outlook and always have.
Right, and they're not necessarily good at fulfilling the what's listed out in all the various initiatives and plans. Right.
What would be a Western appropriate way for us to act? I mean, given that we don't have the same culture as China, how could we act that would be maybe more responsible?
So you would never go work for the government. You, Leo, would never work for the government.
Actually, I might. it's too late for me now. But you know, people like Matt Cutts and the U.S. Digital Service, I think he's doing a very good job of convincing techies who perhaps had some antipathy towards government work to come work for the government.
I agree. And Megan Smith,
our former CTO.
Right. Is brilliant and wise and knows amazing people. The problem is that people alone, like amazing people like Matt and that's not enough. The problem is an institutional one, not a personnel one. So the challenge is that the U.S. Digital Service is not like the Department of Agriculture. So it's funded, but it's not seen as a strong, vital entity. And it's new. So it doesn't have the benefit of having existed for a very, very long time. So there has to be a way, I think, for us to create. Well, I think a good way forward is to take a good hard look at all of our existing departments. This is going to, nobody's going to do this.
This is never going to happen, awesome. Amy. You know that.
This is never going to happen. It's never going to happen, but it's probably a good time to audit the functions of the government and to rename a bunch of those departments.
We should modernize the government. Every president for the last 8 years has said we should, or 20 years has said we should do
but
that. This is what makes America America, for better or for worse, is we let private industry do it. That's why we have the G Mafia. Government is temporal and really doesn't seem to have any long-term plan. And we're not a dictatorship. Extremely strong leadership to say, this is all wrong. Let's sweep the chessboard clean and start over again. That's not going to happen.
I totally agree. But when on the opposite, in absence of having strong central leadership in this country, what we have on the other end of that spectrum is the market. And the problem with the market is, first of all, there's a lot of other variables that cause stocks to go up and down and investments to happen. Twitter and Elon, whatever he's thinking for, those 5 minutes. So there's a lot of other factors, right?
Yes.
But I'm bringing up Elon.
It's getting more of a pendulum swing.
It's bad.
Yeah, faster.
It's bad.
The clock's ticking faster.
But that becomes a problem because now we're making decisions based on money.
It looks like a random walk, to be honest, perhaps in the direction of value creation. But,
and again, there's no strong leadership.
Right.
So, and here's another great example. Just this morning, SpaceX is getting ready for its Dragon launch tonight. Sometime early Saturday morning, March 2nd.
Yep.
Boeing is also working on a similar project. Why? Because the United States hasn't sent a human up on a United States vehicle in 8 years. Why? Because we haven't had funding. And so the government has sort of, thank God the private sector exists and there's companies who are willing to spend a ton of money to make this happen. But you have to ask ourselves when we're talking about fundamental technologies where profit is a motive, and I don't begrudge these companies the ability to make a profit, but sometimes, that desire to earn the profit butts up against what's in our best interests. And it's hard to make those short-term sacrifices. It's really hard when money is on the line.
I am not an avid follower of Adam Smith and the invisible hand of the market and so forth. But if you gave me the choice between a top-down system as the bats have in China, and kind of our freewheeling, let the market decide, many companies attempt. I'd prefer what we have, honestly. I prefer to live in a country like that. And I think that time has shown that that actually is a very effective system.
Sure, but can't there be another option?
A third way?
I guess is my question. A third way.
Yeah.
And that third way is going to require a leap of faith and some more sophisticated thinking. But is there a way for us to create some kind of center of gravity that is both public and private, which is to say the G Mafia and universities and everybody in that ecosystem, plus the government, and it has an enforcement mechanism and the ability, and it has funding, and it has all the stuff that it would need to create guardrails, to do some of these other things, to set not regulations, but some expectations that are more meaningful. I think there is a way forward that's, it doesn't have to be zero sum.
Yeah. Actually, it looks like we might be moving. We might be moving in that direction because people are starting to realize the danger of the G Mafia's control. Ultimately, and you talk about this in the book, if all your data is owned by one of the G Mafia, that's bad.
Right? Yeah. So check this out.
Okay, we have a goal now, which is some sort of guardrail, some sort of system, a third way. Why do we need to do that? Let's talk about the risks.
Well, it depends on what you value. So one of the scenarios that I've outlined in the book is if we wind up with widespread consolidation, and it's likely that our data, all of our data, are probably going to be owned by a single entity at some point, then what does that imply for our futures? It implies that basically you are a Google, or you are an Apple, or you are an Amazon, and you and your life may not be interoperable with somebody else. I mean, I know that sounds nuts. However, did you know that Amazon has been getting into the home building business?
No. Oh, yes, yeah, I did. So there's a big development company that builds Alexa into your house.
It's not just Alexa. So yes, Alexa, but all of the other equipment too. Your smart microwaves.
Oh wow.
Your Ring. Yeah.
Great. Then it all interoperates. That's wonderful. So you're absolutely right. The trend is, and you can see these companies doing it. They want you to be an Apple home. They want you to live in the Apple ecosystem. Everything's better in the Apple ecosystem. And Google, same thing. And Amazon, same thing. In fact, the one company that may not feel that way is Microsoft, but I think their attitude is, but we'll own the back end for all of it, so we don't really care.
So you could say, well, then who cares? Like, what's the big deal? From my vantage point, the big deal is that this is what this makes a lot of our future life a lot more complicated than it needs to be. Think of how hard it is to switch between operating systems on a computer, or like this takes the, are you a PC person or an Apple person, injects it with like billions of steroids.
Yeah.
It changes what our, it can, like in a weird sort of paradoxical way, it kind of makes the, it means that we like have an abundance of stuff and no choice.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a, right?
We're seeing it right now. And I agree with you. I pushed against that for a long time. I'm a big believer in open. And it's very clear that the lack of interoperability is going to get worse, not better. And that you, if you have an Echo, you're going to be in the Echo ecosystem. And you're going to want to, because everything will work nicely. But when you go to the store, you might as well just divide the store up into sections. Okay, all you Amazon people, go that way, because... Not that anybody's ever going to go to the store again.
So in the scenarios, this is how I sort of explain how all of this plays out in the book. What if it's the case that we don't go to stores because there's no need to, because we're subscribing to things?
Right.
And what if it's the case that Amazon emerges as the company that's best equipped and best handled to manage big government contracts? To me, it's Amazon. I grew up on the near the south side of Chicago, 10 miles away from where I grew up is now a cluster, like in the middle of nowhere is a cluster of Amazon homes.
Yeah. They're doing the same thing with Sidewalk, or Google's doing the same thing with Sidewalk in Toronto.
Sure.
It's a Google village.
Right. So what if Amazon becomes the government, like what if Amazon gets the government contract on low-income housing?
Right.
Right. And if you need subsidies, you're living in an Amazon home, maybe that's not so bad. Well, maybe in exchange for that, Amazon is constantly collecting your data. And, you know, that microwave that everybody loves to make fun of, the people who know about it, that, you know, Amazon's microwave. When you order a subscription to popcorn, Amazon knows that you bought the popcorn, but it doesn't know, like, the data trail ends
when you cooked it. Now it does.
Right. Every time you bought, that's right. So,
but there's
like
a great convenience, Amy, because when I run out, it'll know and it'll send me more.
Or when you've had your when you've eaten your maximum number of calories every day, you get nudged by Amazon and locked out of your.
It turns
your
off the microwave.
That's right.
But we'll all be happier, healthier. Yeah, this is a very.
Like this is the whole center of the book is talking about what is all this,
wild.
How could all of this unfurl?
You and can see it happening. It's happening right now. It's happening.
And I guess what I'm thinking is there is no way to unplug. And I don't love the fact that a handful of people are making these decisions for me that I no longer have any control over.
Yep. And in a way we've kind of acceded to it because it is convenient. You know, the human brain is very limited in its ability to handle process and handle everything going on. And we already have a very well adapted ability to narrow our focus. Otherwise, we wouldn't get anything done. Mm-hmm. Why not eliminate all the hard things like where I get my popcorn and whether I've eaten enough popcorn? Why not just eliminate that so we can, you know, think about more important things like what's going to happen next on Game of Thrones?
Right. So in part because I think it's going to start creating new economic and digital divides that we've never thought, like we've never had before.
Yeah.
And
it's trench warfare. We're in the Amazon trenches. You're in the Google trenches. They're in the Apple trench. We can't get out of our trench.
Well, and the problem is that the trench plugs into other things. So Google and Apple are both getting into they're both starting to look at energy usage. And it's not inconceivable to me that they become brokers of you know, utilities. Amazon, Apple, and Google are all getting into healthcare. I mean, this is the thing. It's not like these technologies overlap in ways that they didn't in the past. And so when I've heard people talk about wanting to break up Amazon and you can just spin off AWS from the rest of the company, that, like, first of all, Amazon is not baby. You can't make a bunch of baby bells out of Amazon.
Right.
Doesn't, like, that's not,
no.
It doesn't make any sense.
No.
Right.
It's a holistic system.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so how do we individuals fit into that system? And then how do people outside of the
US,
the
raw materials.
We are.
Let's
which is
it.
Why, which brings me back to you. The conversation that I have had, I've had so many conversations with people in DC. Anytime I get a call from anybody working in Washington, whether it's a congressperson or a staff person, I always take the call. I always do everything that I can
Good.
To help.
Thank you.
The difference between the conversation that I have with them and the conversation that I'm having with you right now is that you have institutional knowledge. You have a wealth of knowledge. You are able to contextualize and make connections between dots and think about what it all means. It would be great if there were a ton of people just like you who were incentivized to join the government, you know, in various different capacities. But that's just not the case.
Right.
I mean, you know, and that's part of the problem.
Well, and then there's also another governmental interest, unfortunately, which just plays right into, which is the panopticon, the desire in this era of terror to know everything that's going on. And the nice thing about these companies is they're very willing to share their data with law enforcement. And so I think there's...
But they are willing or they aren't?
I think the G-Mafia are. And
huh.
Right?
I don't know.
They pretend... No. They pretend not to.
Yeah.
Because that's bad PR. But what are they going to do with a – they can't fight a lawful subpoena. And
yeah,
so
that's true.
There is always, I think, there's always going to be a little bit of give and take. And actually, Shoshana Zuboff talks about this in her surveillance capitalism book. One of the reasons it's difficult to regulate these companies is because law enforcement and government kind of need that surveillance capability they provide. And so I think what you have is actually G Mafia, maybe plus DC Mafia, because in a way they do have coinciding interests in the long run. So it's not merely ignorance or a lack of institutional knowledge. There's also, I think, at least among some, are people like AOC, are younger people, smarter people coming into Congress making a difference, you think?
Well, first of all, it's been a half a minute, so
yeah, it's too early to tell. I know, but is that one way to solve this?
Well, so again, like, this is both a benefit and a real problem with a democracy. Anybody can run. I could run. I never, ever, ever would. But anybody.
Well, Brianna Wu. Let's use Brianna Wu. In fact, we're going to.
Yeah. So
the
Brianna,
three of us are going to be together on Sunday, so you can use that opportunity to harangue her. She's running again.
Yeah. Well, I don't think. Listen, I think she wasn't given as fair a shot as she should have been given.
No, of course not.
But yeah, I mean, it's good to have turnover because theoretically, then we have a better representation of everybody's ideas. But when we're, it's hard not to look at China, with some amount of awe, at what they've been able to pull off, and they have a reason for needing to do things like their social credit score and repatriating academics. There's you know, almost a billion and a half people in China. And yes, its economy has slowed down, but not like a ton. And it's going to go back the other direction, which means that we're about to see social mobility in China at a scale never seen before in modern human history. So they have a vested interest in developing systems to exert international influence and also to maintain a lot of internal control over the populace.
And we should say Amy has a lot of experience with Asia. She lived in Japan for some time. She's a fellow of the U.S.-Japan Leadership Program. And you also served on the U.S.-Russia Bilateral Presidential Commission on the Future of Technology, Media, and International Diplomacy. So you have eyes wide open when it comes to the various ways of the world. But it sounds like you're kind of envious of the monolithic government structure in China.
I'm not envious. I certainly don't listen. I also lived in China. There's no, you know, not going back.
Yep.
So it's not that. It's not that at all. It is, you know, we are all living through a significant transformation. That is like the Industrial Revolution. At the end of the Industrial Revolution, the world was divided differently. The world looked very different, acted very different. So we're the ones going through it. It's happening seemingly slowly, but we're the ones living through this significant change.
Yeah, we and our children will almost certainly bear the brunt of this change.
Right.
And if you look at the consequences of the Industrial Revolution and the 100 years after it, two major world wars, hundreds of millions of people, death, famine, a considerable disruption of the way the world used to work. In the long run, at the other end, I think we are beneficiaries of it. But it was pretty horrible for the first 100 years.
That's right, which is why when people start talking about artificial superintelligence and killer nanobots, you know, all kinds of different things like that, they are certainly interesting to think about. But my concern is that generally intelligence, or let's say strong AI, will start making decisions in ways that make our lives so profoundly uncomfortable. You know, that is much more it's much more plausible that that's going to happen.
Although remember, Chairman Mao made decisions that caused hundreds of millions of people to die of famine in China.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a single decision maker can be bad if it's human. It might be better if it's AI. So let's follow this road a little longer. This is what Amy Webb is so good about. She's a futurist, author of her new book, The Big Nine, How the Tech Titans and Their Thinking Machines Could Warp Humanity. And she's talking about, in some respects, the six in the U.S., the G Mafia, and the three in China, the BAT. So you've talked a little bit about what America is going to look like, a little bit about what China is going to look like. It sounds like at some point there might be a conflict between the two.
Right. And I think, again, you know, we're going to know when the shots have been fired, when you and I are chit-chatting like this on Skype and the lights start flickering intermittently and there's no transformer that's blown anywhere and there's no storm outside and it seems weird. And, you know, we start to see ourselves locked out of our devices in strange ways. We start to see some of these automated answering systems in our inboxes go a little haywire. China doesn't have to shut off our internet or, you know, screw with our financial systems to wreak havoc, not just in the United States, but all around the world. Why would they, what would be the net benefit to something like that? Exerting control and exerting global influence.
Yeah, you know, the next war will probably not be fought with artillery and
no, it'll be fought with code.
It'll be fought with code. Now, yeah. I have talked to some who say, and they were criticizing my understanding of China, that China, while it wants to control its people inside its borders, is not as interested in controlling people outside its borders. It's actually interested in global trade, free trade, and and economic development. That's the whole point of the Belt and Road Initiative.
Right. But what's going to compel a company like the Philippines, or country like the Philippines, for example?
Money. They offer them money.
Okay. Well, at some point, the Philippines isn't going to be able to pay back.
Doesn't matter. Development deals. You become part of the greater economic, co-economic sphere.
Right. So that. So here's what's interesting to me. What's interesting to me about this is, let's say that we fast forward a little bit, and the 58 countries that are currently part of the BRI pilot, all of the citizens in these countries have social credit scores or some kind of score that's akin to the social credit score. That sort of functions as their ability to travel between those countries, to do trade between, or to purchase stuff. And let's say that companies wind up having a similar kind of rating score, similar to the way that we score companies in the US. So China could do some damage by mandating that its partners that are part of the BRI only do business with those countries, companies, and individuals who have a score.
Like, why would they do that? What would be their interest in doing that?
To push economics incentives in different ways.
But again, my point is that China's, I understand why China would want to control people inside its borders, because they want a stable economy. They don't want Muslims in the West getting, you know, causing problems with strikes and stuff. They want it to be orderly. But outside of that, I think they're a little bit more. Go ahead.
Well, if China was a little less self-sufficient, I mean, they have considerable, they own a considerable amount of foreign debt. But let's say that they were less, they were more self-sufficient, less reliant for certain things from outside countries. And let's say that, you know.
Are they economically reliant on oil or food or other things produced outside? I mean, it's a big country. Do they really need any resources?
Sure. I mean, a lot of that country is desert. So it's not, you know, I mean, there's a lot of, and there's a lot of people, there's a lot. We're making big, huge, sweeping generalizations
here.
Yeah,
I understand.
Again, this is why it's useful to look at AI and policy and a bunch of other technologies at the same time. So if you think about genomic editing and CRISPR and like, you know, like that, whole area
that's going to change things.
Which well, but so gene editing isn't just for humans. So you can also do a lot with plants. Right. And if you look at collaborative robotics and all the different experiments we're seeing in indoor plant farming, China's in a part of the world where if the climate continues to change, a lot of us are going to run out of food, right? Because we're going to have a harder time growing things. So there is a If you're a long-term planner and you're trying to think through how do we best maneuver ourselves for the future, becoming entirely self-sufficient is a good move. Like the ability to become self-sufficient, right?
Yeah.
You don't have to turn that key, but having that ability is a really smart move for a country with a ton of people who, if they wanted to, could revolt and overturn the government.
Yeah.
So that's what I think is I think all of these pieces fit together in this sort of puzzle that's hard to see if you're looking at the pieces individually.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. But that's your job. You are.
That's my job.
You're the puzzle maker, the puzzle assembler, the puzzle solver for all of us. All right. Well, you asked an interesting question. You said, oh, Leo, you'd never want to be in government. Is that a problem? Is that the best people don't want to be in government? Certainly, if you wanted to be in government these days, if you want to become an elected official anyway, you would have to run a gauntlet that is insurmountable for most normal people. Nobody's going to have a perfect record. I inhaled.
Yeah. no kidding, right?
Who's going to run? And then what? Why would they run? Why would they run that gauntlet?
I don't know. Like listening to, like watching Brianna go through that whole.
It was a nightmare.
Why would anybody?
She was so
anybody
brave.
Put themselves through that?
Yeah.
Totally. I don't know. Here's what I think. I think that. Somehow both the military and the government have really gotten a bad rap in the U.S. over the past couple of decades for totally legitimate reasons.
Yeah, they earned their reputation in some respects.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. However.
But we need them.
We need them. We're also citizens of this country, right?
Yes.
So the challenge is that there's we need to start building bridges and relationships. There's a handful of people, Ash Carter, who is now at Harvard, but was in the Obama administration. He's been working really, really hard in the space. Joshua Marcuse, he's the executive director of the Defense Innovation Board, has been working his rear end off trying to create great solid inroads between and relationships between people working in the Valley and people working in D.C. But it's hard. The government has a PR issue. Trying to sell people on the idea of you know, civil service.
Especially, and, unfortunately, among the tech crowd who are mm-hmm. primarily libertarians and anti-government. And
yeah. Listen, I am firmly on the side of smaller government. I don't like any of the labels. I don't feel like I fit into any of the categories. But I feel very drawn to giving my work back to to the public and service of the future.
Yes, because government is us.
Yeah.
And it's how we as a society move forward. And
so, but there's no way I would go work for the government. It's like, that's the problem. Like, there's no way. I love my schedule. Yeah. I like working fast. I like having there's no way. There's no way.
I tried briefly. I worked on a committee for the city of Petaluma locally. It was the worst nightmare of my life, and I quit because, A, it didn't match my schedule, but, you know, I couldn't even be there. But, B, it was very difficult, and it takes a certain personality to work in politics, to build the consensus and to get things to move. And the problem with techies especially is we're very black and white. We know what's mm-hmm. right. We know what's wrong. And the idea of consensus is in some ways anathema to us. It's just something that's, it's right. Why do we have to make compromises? Well, this is right.
So yeah. And also just,
not well suited to it.
That's right. And so that's why I keep coming back to this middle ground.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. Like, there's gotta be a middle ground. I think Matt, doing work in the Valley, I'm sure he'll return at some point. Spending a little bit of time in D.C. is
really
great.
Enjoying it. I've talked to him quite a bit. He's been here several times, and he really likes it. And it is altruistic. It is out of giving back. It's out of all those things we talked about. How important it is that government not be seen as an alien entity, but as a reflection of what we as a society want. And I think he really, I don't know that he's going to run away at some point. I can't speak for him, but I think he's really digging it. And I think he knows what difference he's making in the face of all of that bureaucracy.
Right. So, we'll see. I guess when it comes to AI, there's a tremendous amount of misplaced optimism and fear.
On both sides. You're right. Yeah.
On both sides.
Yeah.
People working in the trenches who are slogging away are just trying to, they're just trying to get their stuff done, and it's hard, really, really hard work. And we're being fed really salacious headlines, it feels like, every other day. So, I mean, this is, and these enormous companies, the GM Mafia, are doing groundbreaking work, but they're still beholden to Wall Street. And we have a potential political nightmare on our hands with China, not necessarily right now, but something that could unfold, and I think is poised to unfold over the next several years. So my great hope with this book, and just in general, is that we stop fetishizing the future and we're willing to get down to business and start talking in generalities and get the work done.
Yeah. And you're not alone. I see more and more people talking this way. I feel like the world is moving in this direction, and we need serious thinkers to kind of address these issues and find this middle road so that we can enter a future with as minimal disruption as possible that is good for everybody, good for humans particularly. We didn't even talk about inherent biases in AI and how to handle that, but you do talk about that extensively in the book. There's a lot of great information in here and a roadmap for a way forward. I think you could see Amy's extremely thoughtful, spends all her time thinking about this stuff. And that's the other thing we need, is people who are willing to not be seduced by the hurly-burly of daily quotidian Twitters, but focus on, well, what does this all mean and where are we going? The Big Nine is the book, How the Tech Titans and Their Thinking Machines Could Warp Humanity. Actually, I think it's a given. Humanity is changing in that sense. How it's going to change is what it's up to us. Thank you, Amy. I really appreciate your time. If you're going to be at South by Southwest, Amy is going to be a featured speaker down there. We were hoping to go down and see you, but I don't think we're going to get to. But anybody who's in Austin next month should absolutely check out Amy's talk. And so that you can listen intelligently, get the book.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm doing March 9th at 11 o'clock is the big tech trends talk, and then I'll be doing a book signing in the bookstore after that. And
love I to said say next hi. Month, but I realize it's March.
I know, right?
It's March. It's like in a week. How did that happen? Amy, we're going to see you Sunday on This Week in Tech with Brianna Wu. I thought since we have Amy and Brianna, we're not going to have anybody else. And I'm just going to sit back. Because that's going to be a great conversation. I look forward to that, and everybody should read the book. This is a conversation that is so important, we're actually fortunate because I don't think there was a conversation or even the opportunity to have one when the Industrial Revolution happened, but there is this time, and I think this is going to be even more important that we do as humans get involved, because this is the life we and more importantly our children and grandchildren will be living in. And we want to make it good for them. Thank you, Amy.
Thank you.
We do triangulation every Friday, 11:30 Pacific, 2:30 Eastern, 19:30 UTC. If you want to stop by and watch live, you can, twit.tv/live. But for most people, the on-demand version will be the easiest and the best. You can get that at our website, twit.tv/TRI. You can also get it on YouTube. You can listen to it in an airplane if you're on one of the airlines that carries it. You know, the best thing to do would be find your favorite podcast application and subscribe, because I guarantee you every conversation is fascinating. It's really talking to the smartest people in technology, and a lot of times really about what our future is going to be. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you next time on Triangulation.